Called Polycast. I don't suppose you're a Civilization fan.
Civilization?
A computer game.
No.
Oh, that was the whole girl Civ thing. You guys are over that this week, right?
Ah, women. I mean, yes.
Uh-huh. Sorry.
You grossly overestimate Dan's ability to get over stuff.
Welcome to episode 22 of Polycast, now with 50% less Dan Q. Joining me is the aforementioned 50% less Dan Q.
Hello there.
Also joining me is Makalula.
Hello.
And Water Snyders, known as the cutest on the forums.
Woohoo! I'm back.
And a special guest, John Schaefer, known as Trip, of the Firaxis peoples.
Hello, everybody.
Firaxis. As opposed to normal peoples.
Firaxis peoples are better than normal peoples. Didn't you know that, Dan?
We should also dedicate this episode to a certain reviewer of Civilization IV Beyond the Sword out there, PC Gamers Chris Buxton. You don't have to pay for this episode, Chris, but you can if you want to. Chris so far holds the distinction of being the only reviewer to give Beyond the Sword less than 80%.
Uh-oh, what did he give it?
74.
Why?
He actually thinks that Warlords had more content in it than Beyond the Sword.
Yeah.
Sure, he didn't get stuck on the opening screen somehow.
I'm wondering.
Where's the pre-settler mode? I heard there's a pre-settler mode.
They lied.
Everyone has different opinions on these sorts of things. That's why it's entertainment software. He disagrees with most people, but that's his opinion.
That's just one of the more ridiculous statements.
Yeah, he says, I can't help but question the overall value. As an expansion, it's patchy in more than one sense. This is my favorite part. The new elements it adds feel more like a patch than a genuine expansion.
Corporations definitely feels like a patch.
Espionage overhaul? Yeah, they did that in a few hours.
That was done overnight. Drinking.
Oh, you have no idea.
You don't have any plans for the rest of the day, do you, John? No, of course not. Is that person vacuuming or whatever in the background? They're just listening for when you start to answer a question.
You mean that's actually the fan in my poor 6-year-old laptop going? It turns off every so often. Though.
That's Dan's fault. It's all Dan's fault.
We know that already.
From Flato, and he asks, when deciding what features to add to Beyond the Sword, what sources did you look at? For example, Appolton or Civ Fanatics or whatnot. Or were these ideas that have been planned since the time of the original Civ 4 release? And how many were from forum lists, if any?
Definitely a lot of the stuff that we put into the expansion is things that we'd heard about from the forums, Appolton and Civ Fanatics. And there's always been lists of what people want to see in the game. So we had a pretty good idea of what people want to see. Espionage stuff, different types of units. New civs, of course, a staple that can't get away from, I guess. A lot of what we added was pulled from the forums. With regards to stuff that had been carried over from Civ 4 or things that we had planned before, there was really nothing that we went forward with that we had planned out earlier. And it's kind of the same with Warlords. People say, well, Warlords was made, they just took the stuff they couldn't finish with Civ 4 and made an expansion out of it. And that's also not true.
Alex says, we didn't even know that there would be a second expansion pack during the original development of Civ 4. They decided what to put in Beyond the Sword exactly 1 year ago. And almost all of the ideas came from the forums. And in fact, even after implementing the new features, there was reliance on the online community to refine and balance the new features, and in a few cases, the fans gave such great feedback that they scratched the initial design and used their design instead.
Woo.
But no royalties as far as we know. Oh.
And Big Free wanted to know, he has a few Warlords and PBMs and Pit Boss games going. Is he going to have to use the Warlords CD to get into those, or can he just use the Beyond the Swords CD?
I'm not entirely sure of the answer, but pretty sure that you will need the separate discs for each program.
I'll put in my little add-on. Any chance we could ever get a no CD patch so we could be switching all the time?
I don't know. I don't know. It's not up to me.
About as much chance as hell freezing off, probably.
Dang it. I had to ask, though.
Yeah.
How did you get into Civ in the first place, and how did you find Apollaton?
Oh, that was a while ago. The first time I ever played Civ was Civ 2. It was January of 2002. I was in high school, and I was taking a class which was called War, Diplomacy, and Economics, where we actually played a Napoleonic war game, board game. It was a lot of fun, and some of the guys in there, I'd never heard of Civ before, but they recommended Civ 2 because they really enjoyed it. So I went ahead and I got a copy and I started playing it. It was a lot of fun, and it wasn't too long after that that I discovered Civ 3, because Civ 3 had come out a few months before that. I was originally really big into playing mods and those sorts of things. Civ Fanatics was the first place I found, I have to admit, but found a link to a thread which led to Apollaton, and they had some good strategy discussions and some good mod stuff there. So back in early 2002, I went ahead and signed up, and ever since then, you could say I've been stuck with Civ. It's been a good ride.
A surprisingly short ride, I mean, 2002.
Yeah, well...
You make us feel old.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I'm only 22, so I guess I'm one of the young ones. It seems like a while ago now, but 2002 wasn't all that long ago.
While we're waiting for John, we'll all sit here and think about what model of vacuum his computer sounds like.
I told him not to get the computer.
It's definitely not a...
I picked the one that had the microphone, all right? It was either this, or I would be typing. So then Dan would be speaking for both Alex and I. Would you really want that?
Yeah, we wouldn't know when he's making stuff up. No, Tripp said that I was the best podcast host. Really? He says it right here.
No, we know.
You know everyone loves you all equally.
So when you choose leaders for new Civs, or when you choose new Civs altogether, what process do you go to make a selection? When you've chosen the Civs, what do you do with trade balance?
Well, the choice of what Civs and what leaders go into each iteration of Civ, subsequent expansions, is always a very interesting topic. Everyone has opinion on what they would like to see. There's a lot of different groups of people. There's the hardcore history fans who just want guys like Zara Yakub and Siri Iverman, and more obscure leaders, if you were.
Guilty?
Yeah. There's also a significant portion of the people who buy Civ and Beyond the Sword, in particular, who will never have even heard of these kinds of guys, and they will be looking for leaders like Lincoln or like Charlemagne or Sitting Bull. These are more controversial selections for that reason, but we try to take a balance of all different kinds of Civs and leaders, the more historical types like Zara Yakub, and also the more mainstream ones, at least in the United States and in Europe. We have a lot of people weighing in on what Civ's going. It's not just Alex or I's decision. We have marketing, we have the production staff, we have all sorts of people who are weighing in on what goes in. So we try to incorporate as many types of leaders as we can so we can cater as many groups. So hopefully everyone at least doesn't hate the list completely, even if there are some selections they don't agree with.
Have you ever been asked, why is Hitler not in the game?
Only a couple times. I'll lay it down for you all right now. You're never going to see Hitler in a game, so sorry. I have to admit that some of the cooler leaders, I think, are guys like Zara Yakub, who are a little more obscure, but add more flavor to the game than just adding a bunch of the same. I know Wooter thinks the same.
Yeah. Sort of.
Thank you.
So what did you think about the public reaction to when this information came out? I mean, all these threats about the Holy Roman Empire and why the Native Americans and all that stuff.
It was kind of expected. Alex and I are both from communities, so we're definitely in tune with what people want and what their likes and dislikes are. So it was expected. We didn't really expect 20 threads about Charlemagne, but...
We were hoping for more like 40.
Yeah, well, yeah, it would have helped our numbers.
Yeah, but we knew that they would not be terribly popular with a lot of people. And like I said earlier, we try to balance as much as we can what leaders and what civs go in. So there are going to be some that make certain people upset, like Charlemagne and Sitting Bull. And there's going to be some that other people, when they buy Beyond the Sword, they're going to have no idea who they are and be like, well, you know, why didn't you include some guys that I know about? And Civ is a game that appeals to a lot of different people, so we have to do the best we can to provide something that most people enjoy instead of just catering to one group only.
So what is your favorite new leader trait combination, Beyond the Sword, and why?
Probably not going to be too popular, but I have to admit that I really like Sitting Bull, because I'm more of a builder, although I usually end up building and then conquering everyone in the end every game. I'm not sure how that works out, but I at least start every game with the intention of building up economically and playing more peacefully, so Sitting Bull is definitely really well-suited for that sort of role, especially with his unique building, his unique unit, too. There's a lot of synergy there, so... He's pretty popular, too, from what I can tell about people talking about him in the community, so he's probably my favorite to play, even if his historical qualifications may not be as great as some of the other leaders.
And your opportunity to gain favor of Wouter has not appeared.
I'm sure he's crying.
No, you've been able to build up some credit over the past months, years, so
all right.
I can take it.
Fair enough.
It's not like I've been ignored completely.
No, not completely.
Who is this guy with the accent?
Who's this speaking? Who?
You're the target of the envy of thousands of Civ fans around the world as you worked your way up from a lowly fan to a developer. How did that process work? How did you come to work for Firaxis?
For Civ 3, I definitely played probably more of that game than I should have. Fortunately, it did have the upside of me being able to beta test Civ 3 Conquest. I was hoping to beta test Play the World, but unfortunately I wasn't old enough, so they didn't let me.
Now you're really making me feel old.
Yeah. I was 17 when Play the World came out. It makes you feel better, or not.
Not really.
For Conquest, I did beta testing, and that was the expansion that was made together. Firaxis and Breakaway worked on that one. And pretty involved with the beta there. Back when Civ 4 was recently announced. In 2004, I was able to get into the Civ 4 beta test as well, fairly early. I was one of the first few groups of people who were able to join that. From there, I focused a lot of my time on playing around with the modding stuff that Civ 4 had to offer. Civ 4 definitely has a lot more opportunities to create things with the mod tools than Civ 3 or Civ 2 or pretty much any game, really. And there's just so much that you can do. And I was really excited about that because I'd created some mods in the past. They had posted a job opening for a scenario designer, so I went ahead and applied for that. I was told that I didn't have enough experience, or any experience really. They told me that they wouldn't be able to hire me for that position, but because I'd done some good work with the modding and they were familiar with the stuff I'd done in the past and that I was dedicated, they offered to provide me with an internship. I agreed, and I became a temporary intern programmer for about 6 or 9 months in 2005 during most of the development of Civ 4. It's been a lot of fun, it's been a lot of hard work, but definitely wouldn't want to do anything else. It's definitely very rewarding.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
Sorry, what's that, John, we were talking over top of you? Again?
Oh, nothing. I wasn't talking about you, I promise.
Why did I agree to do this crap? Maybe Dan should read this one, since this is another one of his questions.
No, it's not.
Uh-oh.
No, but I'm curious, too. Was it a conscious decision to have 7 corporations in the game the same number as religions?
Ooh.
Couldn't have had 8 or 10, but you picked 7.
We were hoping to add 300, but we were told that we couldn't do that. We ended up with 7 instead. Alex was the one who chose what corporations and the number, and his answer is basically that the 7 was essentially to match the same number of religions that are already in the game. That's primarily for interface reasons. You can fit 7 because everything that was made for corporations translates really well from how religions were done. So, like, places where the icons show up, there's 7 religion slots, so we can make a little more room and then have 7 corporations also. You know, it was just a decision that was made based on that sort of thing. Nothing too complicated.
And as far as these corporations go, and did you ever consider using a real corporation names? Because everything in the game is based on real history, and suddenly you have these sort of semi-silly corporation names in there.
Originally, we had some real corporations in, and we looked into the possibility of using some real corporations, and we talked to our legal department, and they're like, "Do you have any idea how much this is going to cost?" And we said, "We can guess." And they're like, "Take them out." And we're like, "All right." Sid Sushi was born. It would have been nice to have real historical ones, but part of the limitation of making a game these days that you can't draw upon whatever you want.
At least we can mod them in.
Yeah. Oh, come on. I mean, you couldn't have put something like McRonald's in there? Nobody would know what you were talking about.
Exactly. Donald McRonald.
We'll tell everyone to contact you then later.
Yeah. And it's more an ask question for Alex, maybe, but was there any particular sort of reasoning behind the names that you chose? Or just completely random fun stuff?
Well, the corporations were chosen with certain roles in mind. Like, we didn't want 5 corporations to all function identically, so we had in mind a corporation that would use up aluminum, a corporation that would use up wheat, a corporation that would use up gold and gems. Alex came up with the names. He essentially just extrapolated from them, like Civilized Jewelers and that sort of thing. Nothing too in-depth.
Mr. Where It's At question.
Is one of his questions.
What is the intended real benefit of corporations? Spreading them in your own cities to gain the extra resources or spreading them in an enemy city to cripple them with maintenance?
It's both, essentially. It depends on what corporation you want and what you have access to. One example that was used a lot before BTS came out was that with standard ethanol, you can acquire oil from other resources if you don't have access to oil. And that's something that's definitely good for you, maybe not something you want to provide your enemy. Depends on what corporation and what you're going for. For example, Civilized Jewelers will give you more culture, so if you're going for a culture victory, that'll be good to spread to your cities, whereas if you have no interest in culture, then, well, it's not going to be as much of a benefit for you, but you might want to spread it to other players to get the benefit from harming them.
Come on, a culture victory is a myth. Everybody knows that. Everybody goes on about goody huts being a myth, but I know a culture victory. That's the real myth out there.
For you, it is.
Alex does add that corporation maintenance is a bit higher than we intended because of inflation, and this will be addressed in the patch. We will slightly reduce inflation, and we will adjust corporation maintenance for inflation, too.
Yes.
What, did I not say that as well as Alex would have? Come on, now. What's the...
I couldn't tell the difference. For a second, I thought he was here.
Next question.
What is your position that some have taken that corporations favor warmongers more than builders, as warmongers are likely to hold more resources through territory acquisition in the earlier game?
Well, I can't say that I have a good answer to that, but Alex does. Well, Alex's response for that is that although corporations definitely have a benefit for the cities that they're in, they're not a huge bonus for those who conquer a lot of cities just because there is the maintenance costs on everything, so you're not able to spread to every city that you have, or if you can, it'll be really expensive, so there are balancing mechanisms in place there.
Yeah, where the warmongers will need to have at least courthouses, otherwise they're broke.
Yeah.
Unless you like going bankrupt, is that good for you? Okay.
Oh, jeez.
I think Mackie wants to read the next one.
Oh, thanks a lot.
She said she did.
Give me the long questions. Why were there none of the corporations that you could use with the great profits? Because once you get the first few in the game and you've built your few special holy buildings and then you have no use for them except maybe popping a tech or a golden age, how did they get left out of corporations?
Well, we wanted each of the great people to kind of have their own unique identity. And the great prophet definitely has its most important use early in the game, as you note, with being able to build the shrines for the religions. But something else that we changed for Beyond the Sword is the ability to start a golden age with only one great person instead of two. So that can be a definite avenue for extra great profits if people want to go in that direction. There's also additional benefits that golden ages provide, so using profits in that way should be more useful than in vanilla and in warlords.
And as Alex adds, profits and corporations don't really mix well.
Oh.
I like Pat Khan's comment, which is, especially when it would be so easy to change great profits to great profits.
We have no response to that.
Like we don't get enough bad puns from you, Dan.
Exactly.
We don't need to outsource the puns.
There's some concern in the community that state property is now unbalanced because it eliminates corporations altogether. How do you feel about this? Again, might be more a question for Alex.
Yeah, Alex was definitely the one who was working on a lot of the corporation stuff. He's answered this question a couple times before, and he feels that it's not flawed the way it's done. He likes it being that way. One of the things that's been a problem with the corporations is the inflation costs, and that's something that's going to be changed in the patch that's coming up, but the system itself, he's happy with.
Okay.
How are you guys determining who's asking the question?
Whoever does it first.
Fair enough.
I guess I'll ask the next one.
Very good. Yes, we're on to warfare now.
Warfare. Woo! Oh, I'm going to ask a Dan Q question. This can't be good. There are those who are not liking the change in siege warfare Beyond the Sword brings to Civ 4, where they can no longer complete a kill by themselves. What is the reasoning behind this?
Well, siege units were never meant to be the primary force of an army. The reason that catapults and cannons and artillery were given the collateral damage ability is to prevent people from wanting to use stacks and also give away to weaken cities enough to be captured. The problem was that it became an uber unit where everyone would just build only those and the collateral damage would be enough to kill everyone off. And we didn't want to continue that, so we wanted to try something different. And the inability for siege units to kill other units was one of the ways that we tried, and we decided to go ahead with that.
All right.
Very good.
Good answer.
We approve.
We have to try to keep in mind design what the original role is for the unit and try to find stats and abilities for each of them that matches the role that we want. Catapult and the other siege units were just so strong and so useful in different ways that we felt the only way to limit their power and bring them more in line with the other units was to prevent them from being able to kill other units. We'll see. If it proves to be a problem, we can always tweak it again in the future, but that's what we've gone with for now.
So why did you decide to leave out the trade boys idea? The idea of being able to pillage over them was like, ooh, fun. What?
Was it ooh fun?
I like pillage, okay?
Trade routes are something that always popped up from time to time in different Civ games. I mean, they were in Civ 2, they were in Call to Power. They've been in different games in different forms, and in Civ 4, originally, there were the trade routes that you didn't really control. You just had them, and then they would give you gold for whatever cities were connected. So there's been a lot of attempts at it, and in Beyond the Sword, we tried something out with trade routes you could actually build on the map, but it was something that just didn't work out. There was a lot of micromanagement involved, because naval units have such great movement ranges, and the open sea is hard to police, more or less. And that basically added up to a situation where it would just be a nightmare trying to manage everything and make sure that people weren't pillaging your buoys, especially with the addition of privateers, where anyone can attack them. We didn't want to put out something that didn't work, so we decided to cut it rather than put it out in a form we weren't happy with.
What's this fun versus realism discussion again? Oh, man.
What was the original reason for trying to include trade routes in the first place, then? I mean, was it to really address a gameplay problem, or just to try and get this feature in, or...?
It was both, essentially. We wanted to find a way to spruce up the late-game economics, and that's kind of the role that corporations found. It was also our hope to make naval combat and naval units more important, just because there's very little reason to build ships, and we want to try to find a way to encourage players to want to have a navy and use it. And it certainly did, but it just wasn't fun. So we had to go with what we had and make sure that we didn't take away from the game more than we were adding to it. So we're trying a couple different things there, but sometimes it doesn't work out.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, you know. Sometimes things just don't work out.
For perhaps future iterations of Civ, do you have, it's highly speculative, any ideas about other ways that we could perhaps boost the importance of navies?
I think there's a lot of different ways that you can do it. The problem that Civ has had in the past is that there really isn't much out there of importance. In Civ 4, water resources were added, like fish and oysters and crabs. And that was something that made it more important to use the water, but it wasn't so important that it was vital to build up a navy to protect everything. So it's something that could definitely be improved on, but as for ideas right now, haven't really worked on that too much yet. We took a crack at it and Beyond the Sword didn't work out. If we ever try it again in the future, we'll have to find a better way.
Yep, it'll be interesting to see something like that in future versions.
Who knows, it's always a possibility.
Did how naval blockades were used in the Call to Power series have any impact on what you did or did not do with introducing them in Beyond the Sword?
Nope, they did not.
Moving on.
Poor Call to Power.
See, we don't just talk about Civ 4 on this show.
I try to make sure we don't talk about Call to Power. But anyway.
Saying that we don't have Solver here, then.
Now, are there any plans to bring significant improvements to naval combat in future patches or expansion packs, like an expansion of the patrol order to include ships intercept enemy fleets approaching your coastline to land troops on your territory?
As Alex said, that's not patch material.
We definitely like to try to find ways to improve things, but unfortunately those sorts of changes are pretty big, and trying to find a good way to implement these sorts of things would be a challenge. We took a crack at it and Beyond the Sword, but we ended up having to cut it, and we had a fair bit of time to try it out, and in the end it didn't work.
So while we're on navies, reworking how the AI is using its own fleets more strategically is well documented now with a bunch of different screenshots that people have posted. But do you believe this is true also of its approach to the air forces? Because I haven't played a game far enough yet to say that myself.
The AI definitely saw a lot of work in Beyond the Sword, and it was improved in almost every single way, especially militarily. And one of the biggest ways it was improved was overseas naval invasions. But it also saw improvement in air combat, but there's always a chance to make things better in the future.
Someone asked something.
I can start asking questions of myself if you really want.
Boxers or briefs?
That's not what I meant, but...
You meant something?
Well...
Espionage. When you're using spies to intercept enemy spies, can it be done on any square or just in a city? Can you, for example, block a land bridge with spies to secure your territory?
Yeah, it can be done on any space, but it depends on what mission they're trying to use. It doesn't have to be in a city, it could be anywhere. It depends on how many spies you want to throw at the problem, I guess.
So it seems that the AI currently prefers to use espionage for destroying tile improvements. Do you agree with this, and should this be addressed in a patch?
We've been receiving a lot of feedback on that, and it seems that the AI definitely likes to blow stuff up with its spies. We're not sure if it's a problem yet, but if it is, then it's something that we can take care of. Right now, we're still just waiting to see how people respond, how it works.
How do you guys plan on fixing the poisoning water supply and marathon mode issue?
It's something that we've definitely heard a lot about so far, and it's something that's going to be fixed in the next patch. It's going to be the same for all the game speeds, so there won't be the ridiculous problem that it has been.
Yeah, Alex says that all game speeds will cause the same effects for the same number of turns, 6, and the missions will cost the same on all speeds as well. That question from Tim Jordan, who goes by Lord Geck on the forums.
We don't make these usernames up, people.
There have arguably been few advantages to saving great people for later game use to this point. Not that we've talked about that on this show. Do you believe there are more substantial reasons now in order to help you to be able to found one or more corporations?
Yeah, corporations are definitely a big part of Beyond the Sword, and since there are so many effects and they're all unique, there's definitely going to be a lot of different strategies that develop around them, so it depends on what your strategy is in the game, what your situation is, what your goals are. You may want to save certain ones in some cases or not in others. It depends on what's going on. So we like to encourage that sort of thing so there's not one obvious way of using them. It gives more freedom to the player.
And what if our strategy is to win, John? What then?
Well, there's always the world builder. That's what it comes down to.
Uh-oh, somebody listens to this show.
Dan's in trouble now.
ICBMs in 4000 BC. Daunting.
Have your individual positions on Golden Ages changed pre to post Beyond the Sword? So in other words, are you more or less likely to pursue them now, Aid of Wonders notwithstanding?
I would say so. It was definitely a goal to make Golden Ages more important. You need fewer great people now, and there are some extra benefits that they provide. Like I said before, it depends on what you're doing in the game and what your situation is, but we definitely recognize that Golden Ages were something that people weren't using great people for as much. We wanted to strengthen them in some way and make them more attractive. And now there's corporations as well, so a lot of things tie into that. We definitely think that we improved Golden Ages in some way, and definitely good for you need to build up an army to go to war. Go on there, say.
So where did the decision come from to include fan mods in Beyond the Sword? And when did you make this decision, and why did you do this and not do everything in-house?
For Beyond the Sword, we had a lot more time than we had with Warlord, so there was an opportunity to incorporate some of the best mods from the community in the game. And this was something that Soren was really a big fan of, too. He really wanted to get Fall from Heaven in an official release. And, you know, we did. It's definitely something that we think is really cool. And there's a lot of cool stuff out there. And anything we can do to try to add more value to the products that we make, like Beyond the Sword, it's all for the best. Whatever happened to your mod, Looter?
Yeah, that kind of didn't really get off the ground. Unfortunately, a little thing called real life interfered.
Real life? What's that?
I don't know.
You're scaring our guest co-host, Wetter. How rude.
But so how did you come to the decision about which mods to include and who to invite?
There was obviously a limit on the number of people we could invite to the group and produce stuff for the game. Some people might remember Civ 3 Play the World, where about 100 mods were included. Many of them didn't work. Many of them had a lot of problems. Some of them weren't as good quality as others, so we knew that if we wanted to incorporate mods from the community into the official product, we were going to have to be more selective and restrict what we added. So we made the decision of only allowing a few mods to go in. With regards to who actually was chosen, like I said, we were really excited about Fall from Heaven. It's the most popular mod, so we were interested in adding that to Beyond the Sword, and that's something that Kale and his team were also interested in. As far as the other two, Rise and Fall and The Road to War, those are both made by guys that had made mods in the past. Ride made the Earth map and a couple other things for Civ 4 originally, and Dale had made the North Africa mod. So those were two guys that we knew could produce high-quality work, and we'd done stuff with before. That gave us the three mods that we were pleased with. That's what we ended up shipping Beyond the Sword with.
All right. So, and about the other scenarios that were developed in-house, I mean, how did you go about selecting the topics for those?
Well, for Beyond the Sword, it was a little different from Warlords. Warlords, there was a definite emphasis on historical mods that were pre-gunpowder, and there were a couple in there that didn't fit the theme, but that's originally what we started with. So that's what most of the mobs and warlords were. With Beyond the Sword, we knew we had extra time, and with extra time, we would have extra art time. For BTS, we had, I think, about 5 or 6 designers working on different scenarios, and each designer got to choose essentially what they wanted to work on.
Okay, and aside from your own scenario, what's your favorite one?
Favorite scenario. Probably have to say that I enjoy Fall from Heaven the most, just because it was quite a bit different from the normal game. I've played a lot of Civ, so I have a lot under my belt there, and it's cool to try out something that's a little different. And Fall from Heaven definitely plays out differently from a normal game, even though it incorporates a lot of elements.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably enjoyed that one the most, even though they were all pretty high quality stuff.
News, email news at apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Snoopy369, Alexander I, or Luminatus via Polton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
Apolton University.
Oh yeah, that's right, we do have that.
If people do want to learn how to play Civ better, there is a good way for competitive playing to have other people give you advice. That's the Apolton University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Apolton.net
really?
/forums?
Wow, how could I figure that out?
I don't know.
Apolton University. Sometimes I wonder.
I'll let Dan figure that out. Make his job harder.
He needs more punishment for that pun. Get it?
Exactly.
Punishment.
I agree.
Punishment.
Okay, now we're gonna have to punish you as well.
So what was the impetus for putting in the Apostolic Palace and its options? Did that come about before or after similar changes were made to the United Nations?
It was something that we wanted to do fairly early on. While we were brainstorming ideas for Beyond the Sword, one of the things that had come up a lot was trying to improve the diplomatic side of the game and the interaction with other players. What we came up with was trying to find some means of getting everyone to work together, and the Apostolic Palace, which is kind of like the UN, was the answer for that. And as the Apostolic Palace kind of became fleshed out, there were some features added there that we felt would be really cool to add to the United Nations as well. So the changes were later incorporated into the UN, but they were definitely something that had come prior to the changes to the UN itself.
Thank you for both the AP and the changes to the UN.
Woohoo! Thank you for something to do with diplomacy in the early ages.
UN's never been the best either, so we definitely wanted to try to improve that in some ways. Did what we could, and Apostolic Palace is a pretty neat addition as well, so happy with that.
Alpha Centauri also had a UN, and most people agree that that was very fun. Did you at least consider making it more like Alpha Centauri and allow for things like vote bribing and stuff like that?
It was something we considered, but changing the core mechanics in a lot of ways of how the UN worked would have been a fair challenge. And because we were adding so many other things like espionage, like corporations, all these different things, and with just an expansion, we realized that our scope for the changes that we were going to make was going to be somewhat limited. The Apostolic Palace was one of the later major features that we implemented, so by the time we started working on it, we knew that there was only going to be a limited amount of time.
And hey, we mentioned Alpha Centauri earlier, and Forest Preserves remind me of that. Were you guys thinking of that when you added that, or was there some other place that the idea came from?
Well, it wasn't something that originated with Alpha Centauri. Like with the trade routes, it was a feature that we wanted to add to encourage certain types of play or certain ways of doing things. it's always been a problem in Civ 4 that all the trees end up chopped down within a reasonable period of time in order to get the production bonus from them. So we want to add a way to allow forests to be useful and to kind of come back without allowing it to be exploitable. In Civ 3, as some people might recall, there was a fun exploit where you could actually plant and chop and then plant and then chop forests and make lots of production that way. And I think it was even worse in previous versions like Civ 2, but I never tried that. We wanted to add some way of making forests more useful and allow players to reconstruct them after they'd been chopped down. So that was the primary reason that the forest preserve was added.
I thought maybe it was because Greenpeace was picketing outside Fraxis's offices.
Fortunately not. We only have groups of people angry about Sitting Bull and the Holy Roman Empire, that's all. We're still on Greenpeace's good side.
Something Alex said, that their happiness provides an extra reason to keep forests around even if you are not an environmentalist, and they give a way to nerf environmentalism, which was slightly too powerful pre-Beyond the Sword under certain circumstances.
We have a question from Monk Spider that's very, very long, so I'll summarize it. What the hell ever happened to the palace screen?
That's exactly how I would have summarized. Where's my palace?
The palace screen is something that just can't seem to go away. For better or worse, I guess. It was something that we originally hoped to add in Civ 4, but we ended up running out of time, even though there's a lot of the code in place. Creating the different palaces, or even one palace, requires quite a bit of artwork. Beyond the Sword was a really big expansion, and we were hoping to add the palace screen back. Didn't end up having the time. Kind of the alternative that we have was the new spaceship screen, where we had our artists working on some cool stuff in there. We always seem to go in with the intention of making it and fleshing it out, but end up having to spend our time on other things.
So sort of in the same vein, was there any other things that were dropped from Beyond the Sword during development that you wish you could have had the time to include?
We had the trade routes. That's something that we were looking at. There was actually something I started working on fairly early in the project, which was a stack combat system. That was going to be a lot of work, and it would need to change the animation system, and it would require the complete rebalancing of all combat. So it was something that it was cool to think about and play around with, but in the end, the amount of work it would require and the potential even damage it could do to the game and how people fight is something we didn't want to worry too much about. So we ended up dropping that from development early on. Aside from that, there wasn't really anything major. If there was something else, it wasn't important enough for me to remember anyway.
Well, there was my scenario.
Oh!
Technically, that didn't exist, so...
That's true.
Good save there, John. Good save.
It's kind of random, but Jet7 wants to know, what is Pericles doing at the beginning of his animation?
I guess that definitely is a miscellaneous question. Our leader head animator, Kevin, he was the guy who did the animations and told me at one point that while he was working on Pericles that he wanted Pericles to be interacting with other people around him and kind of telling him what to do or whatever. Seems like he's kind of motioning them, giving them orders or something. Probably an army, but can't say no for sure. It's up to every player to interpret for himself what exactly is going on, I guess.
As Alex says, not my favorite animation.
But he is great. So.
Yeah, you should like it.
From Simon, also known as Dr. Spike, how much do you feel your Civ experience helps you in your job?
Definitely quite a bit. As some people probably know, or most people hopefully, that both Alex and I originally came from the community, especially Paulton, back in the day. We both played a lot of Civ 3. We definitely have a passion for Civ and a love for it, and that's one of the factors in trying to provide expansion like Beyond the Sword, which has all these different things and incorporates suggestions from the community that we came from. We're definitely trying to cater to people that we know and meet their needs and try to provide them a product that they have a lot of fun to play and will do so in the future. Thank you for the story, John. Well, thank you, John. All right.
Now John's hearing voices. He fits in well here.
I gotta get away from you guys before it's too late.
Oh, it's too late already.
By the time you ask that question,
it already is.
Too late.
A lot of fans are probably jealous of you. They also want to break into the gaming industry. Might be a tough question, but do you have any advice for them on how to go about realizing that?
It's definitely a challenge to break into the industry, especially to do something like design, because a lot of people want to do design, and there are a lot of people with good ideas and a lot of people willing to work hard. So you have to show that you're willing to work harder and be more dedicated and come up with better stuff than the people who are already out there, and that's definitely a challenge. The best way to get in is to try to be as involved as you can. Like with me, with Civ 4, trying to produce as many mods as I could, I was essentially the only one who was making any mods for Civ 4 at that point. Even when nobody was out there playing it, nobody was out there testing it, I still spent a lot of late nights working on code stuff in Python and messing around, trying to tinker with stuff and learn how things work. Just putting a lot of time into it, not just because I wanted to work there, but because I enjoy doing it. And that's really key, just being really passionate and loving what you do so much that you wouldn't even have to have it as a job, that you would do it anyways. And that's something that Sid has said to me and to other people as well. A real game designer isn't someone who gets paid to design games. They're someone who goes and designs games whether or not it's their job, because it's their calling. It's something that they enjoy so much they can't imagine not doing it. Companies these days more and more are looking to the mod communities and the forums and those sorts of things for people that they hire, because they know those are the people that know their games and care about their games. You just have to show that you're a mature person and that you like working hard and that you can interface well with people, and that'll help you out a lot. There are other ways to get in as well. If you're a really talented programmer, if you're a really talented artist, then you can get a job that way as well. It's definitely easier to get a job doing one of those things than it is as design. Very few people end up just getting hired as designers these days, and those who do are people who generally have many years of design experience before. So if you're hoping to just go out and get a job as a designer, that's definitely challenging. It's not unheard of, but it's more difficult than trying to go another way. As long as you care enough and you work hard enough and you stick to it, then you should be able to get what you want.
From JKP1187, do you think the basic Civ 4 engine is sufficiently robust enough to endure for several more years, and thus several more expansion packs, or are you planning on some more revolutionary changes that will bring the series up to Civ 5?
Civ 4 is definitely a very solid base to work from. Making content for Warlords and Beyond the Sword was a lot easier than it was to make content for Civ 3, which is one of the reasons why we've been able to do more. Modders can attest to how flexible and how powerful the setup is as well. We feel that it's something that we could expand on in the future in different ways, but I can't really talk about anything that we might have planned or not planned. I can say that we've been really pleased with how the Civ 4 code has been set up and how everything works together, and you never know, you might see something again.
Oh, come on, John, you can say nobody listens to this show.
Well, that's true.
Well, we don't want them to start, do we?
But what are the practical plans for the immediate future? I assume we can expect at least one patch. Is there anything other planned for Civ 4 for like the immediate future?
There's the upcoming patch. I'm not entirely sure when that's coming out. Producer Jesse's taking some time off right now, and he's working with the guys at 2K and other parts of Firaxis on getting that together. So there will be a patch within the near future. The problem with patches is always that there's a lot of things that you have to go through in order to get them out the door. You can't just make the fixes and then upload it, and you have to wait for the whole process to be going through. There will be some waiting time there, but we're addressing stuff in the patch, definitely, and keeping our eye on the forums and seeing what feedback people have, the things they like and don't. So there's that, but as far as anything else, I'm afraid I can't say, so...
Oh.
You guys will find out one way or the other.
All right.
I suppose if there are people out there that are waiting for the Beyond the Sword patch, they could look into the unofficial patch that Solver has put together.
This is true. He's done some cool stuff, chiefly with the AI, I believe, and that's something people can download to fix some of the problems right now. And there's also some other kind of minor unofficial patches floating around out there. We'll have a lot of the changes incorporated in the official patch that we'll be releasing, but for now, if people want to address some of the things, they have that opportunity.
This from MJW, what have you guys been doing lately other than Firaxis stuff?
Ooh, well...
You have time for anything else?
Well, during Beyond the Sword, really didn't. Alex and I run the office pretty much nonstop. It was pretty intense. It was a lot of fun, but a lot of work. We finished working on Beyond the Sword about a month ago. A little more than a month ago now. August, I guess. Time flies. He and I both went on vacation afterwards. I went back to where I grew up in Colorado for a few weeks. Took it easy for a while. Played some games and read some books and hung out with people. But these days, I don't know. Still reading the forums and trying to work on stuff for the patch and then preparing to work on my next big secret project. It's nothing too exciting right now.
Mm. Big secret project, would that be with a capital B, a capital S, and a capital P?
Oh, you got it. You'll find out about it one day. Don't worry. We're definitely very proud of Beyond the Sword. We had kind of a small team. We only had a few programmers in particular working on the project. We added quite a few things that we wanted to, and it didn't end up perfect, as we know, but we really hope that what we've provided gives the community something that they really enjoy and really excited about and feel that they definitely had a part in its creation by the suggestions that they provided.
So, another Civ 4 expansion is out the door, but we still have no banana unit. What's going on?
Well, the banana is something that we felt that we couldn't legitimately add to the game because it would be too imbalanced. With the interest of good gameplay in mind, we were not able to add it to the game, but we can say, not with 100% certainty, that it may or may not be added in a future patch or version of the game. So stay tuned, and maybe one day we'll find a way to work it in.
Hey, it worked for giant death robots.
This is true. Maybe you just need more threads about it.
So you could say that the banana unit gave you the slip?
Oh.
Jeez.
Alright, I've changed my mind. It's not going in, though.
I don't blame you.
Need to punish Dan somehow for that one.
I have to edit the show. That's punishment enough.
That's true.
No, it's not.
And of course, we saved the most important question for last.
Oh, the usual, do you listen to Polycast? That kind of thing.
Well, I think we've established that.
Yeah,
I've listened to this episode, at least.
Really?
I've listened to some of the shows in the past. I missed some of the recent ones because I was on vacation. I think it's something really cool that you guys are doing, and it's a good way to try to attract people to Civ community and to Apolitan, and I think it's something that's really cool, something that's unique, that no other Civ site has.
Inner.
Yeah, that's true. There's some cool features that you guys have done in the past, and in particular, I really like the one episode that you guys did where you talked about Rise of Nations actually a little bit at the end, kind of going back into the past and looking at some of the things from before. And I think that could be something really cool that you guys do in the future. Maybe look back at Civ 1 or Civ 2, and maybe even Call to Power if you have to.
What? No.
Heaven forbid, I know. No offense, Solver, sorry. I think the one bit where you did the look into the past and see the history of Civ, at least for me, that was really interesting just because I've been so wrapped up in Civ the last, 6 years now that it's just interesting learning and reading about a lot of these things that went on back before I even knew Civ was around. I'll be listening in the future, so keep it up.
Excellent.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't think anyone else has requested more of that feature, although I do think I speak for all of us if I say we'd enjoy that one ourselves as well.
Ah, the time machine. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Feel obligated. Diddle-loop, diddle-loop, diddle-loop. Here you go.
Key.
Yeah, I can just see it now. Polycast, episode 200. Time machine, Civ 4.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we're looking at Civ 10, I guess it'll have been a while ago.
Yeah. That's still a while away.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659. 301-637-POLY.
And for Europe, 44-020-7871-7659. 44-020-7871-POLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
You could always rename the show to that. Polycast. Now, with 100% more Dan puns.
Uh-oh, that might get people to stop listening. Stop listening?
That implies that they're listening in the first place.
One of my friends and I, we went to pick up the game, and I show him how to play a little bit, and he picked up the last copy of Beyond the Sword. They had it, so apparently it's doing pretty well. So.
That's good.
Yeah, we're happy with how it turned out and how it's been going.
It could have either been the last copy of Beyond the Sword, or it could have been their only copy.
It's true. Right. We want the glass to be half full here, Dan.
You mentioned, of course, I'll have to bleep out their name because they don't sponsor the show.
Oh. I better talk to them, though. I'm sure they'll go for something.
John, have you gone back and played Civ 1?
I have to admit, I've never played Civ 1. But I plan to. I have a nice shiny copy of Civ Chronicles, which has every single version in there. Be playing some Civ 1 and some Civ 2 as well. I plan on playing it. Haven't gotten around to it yet.
So you plan on playing it. Well, I'm afraid that's not good enough. What, or did you want to take this?
I think he's asking for the shame on you thing.
Thank you, Mackie.
I don't think you're going to get it, though.
John's earned an exemption from that. He's earned his dues by now.
Yeah, we're sorry Mackie had to say that to you, John. That was pretty mean.
Yeah.
Anyway, you've been listening to Polycast. This is the end of our episode. We'll be back in 2 weeks. I've been Walter Snyders, known as Locutus on the forum. I've been here with Dan.
Hello. Goodbye.
What is it, hello or goodbye?
It's both.
And Maki was also here.
Bye. I have to run from Dan. He's getting weirder.
What?
Yeah. Well, you all have to run from Dan.
You should have gotten a head start long ago. There's no hope for you now.
Imran Siddiqui.
Goodbye.
And with us also was our very special guest, John Schaefer.
Yeah, it's nice to have been a part of it.
Yes, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Trip, for doing this for us, helping us out.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we should ask, would you ever agree to do this again?
Polycast? Not sure, why not? I guess you'll have to deal with the vacuum cleaner, but as long as that's all right, I guess it's not a problem. Yeah, it's been fun. We're really happy to have a community that's as awesome as Civ has, and hope that you guys will keep giving us ideas and complaining about certain things as well in the future, and you'll hear from us again, and we'll try to come out with some more games that you love.
John, we can't thank you enough, especially having to put up with all of us, some of us more than others. Hey, Moran.
I've been stuck in Apolliton now for just over 5 years, so I figured I should try to help out a little bit, I guess.
Oh, you're stuck in a moment and you can't get out of it. There you go. I hadn't sung the whole episode, you can blame John.
Almost. Yeah. Almost.
Well, there's just a moment I'm definitely stuck in and can't get out of it.
Oh, I collected all these news stories for nothing.
Oh.
You did? Oh, yes, that's right. In the news, Civilization IV Beyond the Sword was released, and reviewers liked it, and so should you.
Key?
How was that? Did I miss something?
No, I think that about covers it.
date August 4th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV and its Warlords and Beyond the Sword expansion packs. Stuck in a moment you can't get out of by U2 Clip Copyright Island Records. Copyright 2007, a Poulton Civilization site at apoulton.net.